The Book Nook on WYSO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McInnes, and I am thrilled to introduce my guest to you. She joins us on the telephone in Denver. It's Louise Penny. Good morning, Louise.
Hi, Vic. How are you?
Louise, I've wanted to interview you for years, and so I'm so happy to be able to actually talk to you for the first time.
Thank you, and I you. Was I playing coy? Was I playing hard to get?
No, I don't think so. You've just been on my list. I don't think that you've been playing hard to get at all. And fortunately, you are so prolific that I keep having opportunities like this one to actually connect with you.
You know, the truth is that's the only reason I'm writing books. I keep saying, I didn't get on Vic's show. I need to write another book.
Oh, my. Okay. And we have some prime swampland we'd also like to sell. I'm just kidding.
I got my checkbook out.
Louise, you have a new book called Glass Houses. This is a very well-received series. You have many avid readers. Tell us about this series. How did it start, and what's it about?
Well, the series is set in Quebec, which is where I live, just south of Montreal, not far from the Vermont border. When I first started thinking about it, I decided a couple of things. You know, I had no great expectation that the books, or particularly the first book, of course, would be published. Not because I thought that it would be unpublishable, but just because it's so difficult these days, and always has been, to get the attention of editors and agents. So I thought, I have to love writing it. That it will probably be the only reward I get. So when I sat down to design this book, I made wall-to-wall selfish choices. I created a village I would choose to live in, and that's the setting for all the series. It's called Three Pines. It's a small town near the Vermont border in Quebec. I populated it with people I would choose as friends, whose company I would enjoy in the 2 or 3 years it would take to write the first book. And the main character, Armand Gamache of the Sûreté du Québec, that was a little bit more problematic. Initially, I was going to make him someone deeply troubled, at war with himself, maybe an addiction or a bad marriage or just a violent streak. And I thought, why would I create a character whose company I wouldn't enjoy? So I decided to make Armand a man I would marry. And I gave him all the qualities I admire, not just in a man, but in a human being. And that's become the template for the stories. But the books, while clearly crime novels, murder mysteries, I think that the least interesting element is the crime itself. That's the starting point. They're not about murder and death. They're really about life and the choices we make.
And you just mentioned that you chose to, instead of having a troubled relationship, you chose to have a protagonist who has a happy marriage and is someone that you would want to be married to yourself. They really do have an incredibly happy marriage. Tell us about this relationship.
Well, his wife is named Reine-Marie, and yeah, they're the love of each other's lives. He's in his mid-50s, as is she, and they have a couple of children, and it's a relaxed relationship. They kid each other. I wanted to make Armand a man who can not only love others but can receive love, and they're actually two different things, and not everybody is able to receive love. Like, not everybody receives compliments graciously. Armand can feel love for others and feel the love of others for him. It's a solid relationship. It's one where you're not going to read the books and think that he's beginning to fall for someone else. You know that that's just not going to happen. Mm. She's a librarian, works with the National Archives in Quebec, and I did that because librarians for me have always been heroes. So I wanted to give a homage to librarians. It's not actually unlike the relationship I had with my husband Michael.
Mm. Librarians are my heroes too. They've opened so many worlds.
Nobody becomes a librarian for fame or fortune or power. They do it for the love of books and the love of wanting to pass that on.
Louise Penny joins us. Her new novel is Glass Houses. How many books is it now for you in this series?
This is, it's almost shocking for me to say it, the 13th.
Mm. And do we need to let our listeners who aren't familiar with the series know about some of the earlier history? Because there have been some changes in the life of your protagonist. He's been moving through the ranks. Do we need to tell them any of that?
Well, maybe. Thank you for putting it like that, Vic. I really appreciate it because on the one hand, it is important to know that the characters evolve. I had heard when I was first thinking about these books and early on that Agatha Christie had grown weary of Poirot. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't think of Gamache as Poirot or these as Christie-esque at all, but that was something I took on board because I thought I don't want that happening to me and my characters. And looking at Poirot, and I'm a great admirer of what Christie has done or did, it's not surprising to me because Poirot did not evolve. He was essentially the same character at the beginning of the series in the 1920s as he was in the 1960s. And I didn't want that to happen. And I didn't want to. The other danger was falling into a rut, becoming formulaic, and that does not interest me at all. So every book needs to be different in tone, often different in structure, while still maintaining the same characters and setting. So Gamache at the beginning is a man who's obviously admired, is very good at what he does, but has hit a ceiling because he has called out police corruption. And while some of that has been rooted out, though not all, it is not something that has been rewarded within the service. And so we see him as the series progresses, challenging his superiors and the consequences of that, but both professional but also the deep personal consequences he suffers.
In this book, I would say that he's really facing an existential crisis. If I had to pick one word to represent the theme, it would be conscience.
Mm. Yes, there is a quote from Gandhi that informs much of this book, and I don't have it in front of me. I'm not going to get it quite correct, but it's along the lines that there is a higher court than the courts of justice, and that's the court of the conscience, and it supersedes all others. And I use that, and one of the characters quotes it, and then they have discussions, not great long discussions, but it's a difficult one because while it's a Gandhi quote, you know where that's coming from, and it's the civil disobedience of Martin Luther King and the acts of great courage to challenge laws that people feel are unjust. It can also be a call to fascism, to terrible acts, to give people permission to do vile things in the name of their conscience. And it has happened a lot. So it really is you're right, it is a discussion of the place the conscience plays in our lives and our acts and how much it's being used as an excuse. But yes, Gamache is deeply troubled by a decision that's facing him that other people that we've come to know and respect and admire in the series think he is about to make a horrific decision and the wrong decision, and they're begging him not to do it, and he's facing having to make this decision and leaning in a certain direction.
Louise Penny joins us. Her new novel is Glass Houses. I like the fact that when I read your stuff that there's a sense of calmness and dignity, and there's a little humor there to kind of smooth out the violence. And this little village is such a wonderful creation. I know it doesn't really exist, but you've got these characters there, and I always look forward to the lady with the duck.
I'm so glad you said that. Thank you. But not but, and I know that people who are listening, who, and there are many of them, who haven't read the series yet, and they hear that there is a lady with a duck, I can see them reaching for the button to turn this off and say, now there's a book I don't want to read. Because it sounds on the surface of it silly, but again, so much of this is an allegory. It's symbolic. The duck is, in one of the books, this poet, Ruth Zardo, an elderly, very troubled woman, finds a duck egg and decides, or two of them, and decides to try to hatch them. And one of the ducklings survives and one of them doesn't. And it becomes, as I say, an allegory for Ruth's life and Ruth's choices. And she bonds with the duck and the duck bonds with her. So it's not quite as silly as it can sound on the surface. But I'm glad about what you say about the calm. I read a lot of poetry, and passages of poetry inspire almost all of the books, different passages for different books. But one that is a constant through the series are a few lines from Auden's Elegy to Melville. And those are, he says, goodness existed. That was the new knowledge. His terror had to blow itself quite out to let him see it. How amazing is that? Mm. How amazing. And I know in my life too, but just that in order to really come to a deep and profound sense of goodness and that calm you were talking about, so often that comes from having experienced terror to begin with. Real terror, not the stuff that we can manufacture and project, but to actually be through hell and come out the other side. And when we come out the other side, we know what hell is, but my God, we know what heaven is as well, and we know what calm is, and goodness. And that's what I'm trying to get at, is that, yes, terror exists, hell exists, but the other exists as well. And I know it for a fact. It's not some marketing tool. I'm writing this from a place of knowledge. I don't expect other people to agree, but that happens to be my worldview.
As we proceed through this novel, we pivot back and forth through time. There's a trial going on, and Gamache is testifying, and he's being questioned by the prosecutor, who in these sorts of situations would be considered his ally, and he would be a friendly witness, Gamache. And then we go flashing back through time to the events that led to the trial. And I thought it was very clever how, as we're reading it, you occasionally will allude to the defendant, but we can go hundreds of pages without figuring out who the defendant is. And we almost forget there is a defendant.
That was important to me. Thank you for saying that. I wanted to play with the issues of structure. In the series, up until this book, the stories had stopped at the arrest, essentially, and then there's often some other issues personally, of the personal nature of the characters, but the plot lines itself ended with the arrest. We never saw Gamache in a courtroom, and I thought I wanted to see him in the courtroom, but and to describe what was happening in the crime, but then not actually know, as you say, who the defendant is and who has been murdered. And I also wanted to try to work with having the flashbacks to the crime, to weave it in so that it wasn't jarring, so that it wasn't one chapter in the courtroom and then the next chapter back in Three Pines 6 months earlier and then back to the courtroom, so that as he's describing it, almost imperceptibly, we slip back into scenes from the past, so that the present becomes the past becomes prelude, so that there is an almost imperceptible time shift, and see how long I could stretch it out before having to reveal who was murdered and who the defendant is, and then time, past and present, collide, and then we move forward for the final quarter of the book.
Well, it was beautifully executed, and
thank you.
I really enjoyed that. My guest is Louise Penny. Her book is Glass Houses. I'm leery of spoilers. I'm trying to tiptoe here. I know I need to be very careful. Can you set the scene? Can we talk about is it a cobrador?
Yes. To be honest, I wouldn't. Thank you for asking about that. And I was very leery about talking about it at first. But to be honest, a lot of the reviewers are already talking about it. And I don't think it certainly doesn't give away any huge whodunit issues. Mm. The cobrador is something that I had heard about long before I started writing the books. My husband had a great friend who worked for the Financial Times in Spain. And he came to visit us 20 years ago and told us about the Cobrador del Frac. The Cobrador del Frac is mostly a man. He wears a top hat, tails, carries a briefcase, and he follows people around one person at a time, picks them up at their house, follows them at a respectful distance to their work, to lunch, stands outside the restaurant, and just stares. Never approaches, never talk to them. If confronted, doesn't engage, just stands there and stares silent, mute, and then continues following them. And everybody in the community knows what the cobrador is. And the cobrador del frac is a debt collector. And the person they're following has an unpaid debt. And what the cobrador does is he shames the person into paying the debt. There's no physical threat. They don't come and confiscate anything. It is a public act of shaming. The cobrador is, in effect, a conscience. And so I tucked that away as something so haunting and so macabre that I never forgot it. And then when I started writing the series 13 years ago, I remembered it and thought, one day the characters will be at such a stage, I will be at such a stage as a writer that I can do this character of the cobrador and the conscience justice. And the time came with Glass Houses. And what happens, without going into too much detail, is that a type of cobrador shows up in this village of Three Pines and stands sentinel on the village green, just staring. And each of the villagers believes he's there for them because each of them has a secret.
And I will reveal that this creature makes its first appearance at a Halloween party. And,
yes.
And I love that.
Oh, good.
I went to a Halloween party one time dressed in a costume that no one could tell who I was. And I didn't speak. And it really creeped people out. They didn't like it. It made them very uncomfortable. Who are you? They kept demanding to know, who are you? You're making me nervous.
And that is so interesting. So they didn't find it funny?
No.
They, as you said, they got really uncomfortable. Did you do it on purpose?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Out, or were you surprised by their reaction?
I was troubled by their reaction, but I had to stay in character.
Mm-hmm.
If I made a noise or a sound, it would be just sort of a grunt.
Wow. How long did you keep that up, the whole party?
Until people started figuring out who I was.
Or you got hungry and wanted the canopy.
There you go. But it reminded me of your arrival of the cobrador. And
I'm so glad. I thought, I tried to imagine what it would be like, because, of course, he's also masked, as you say, that they don't know. Is he? They assume he's a villager. But it is, again, so macabre. And then the next morning, he's still there in costume, just standing and staring. At that point, they realize that there is something very troubling happening.
And as readers will discover, there's a lot of stuff involved with this creature, and you have some complex twists and turns, and this is a very timely book. I don't want to talk about why, but I think that readers will come away with an understanding of just what a perilous time we live in right now.
Thank you. I did that on purpose, and I see so many parallels with times past, where we have all been asked to look deep and to not just philosophize, but we are called to act.
I heard a rumor that you grew up in a household that had some mystery novels in the library.
Yes. That was my first. I have such affection for the crime genre, crime fiction. I like most people, I read small c Catholicly. I read memoirs and nonfiction and literary fiction, poetry, everything. Anything, cereal boxes, anything I can get my hands on. But I have a particular, as I say, affection for crime fiction. It was the first adult book. I still remember my mother handing me an Agatha Christie. I think I must have been 10 or 11 and saying it was still warm from her hands when she just finished it. Mm. And she said, I've just finished this and I think you'd like it. And it was a seminal moment of not passing the torch, but sharing something that was so important to my mother, to both my parents, reading. And that this would be a book that she had read. It was the first time I read the same words she had read. We could discuss it. And later on in life, as a mother and daughters, we didn't always get along. Sometimes fought, sometimes had falling outs, and sometimes were on the verge of saying things that could never be unsaid. And our white flag was always turning to each other. Instead of saying that one step too far, one of us would say, what are you reading?
Mm.
And that would become then the safe spot, the common ground where we could claw our way back to a loving relationship. And it started with crime novels.
I love that story. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. And it's my pleasure to have Louise Penny on the program today. Her new novel is Glass Houses. And Louise, I read in a lot of genres, but I hate the idea of categorization. I just love literary fiction. I love a book that I love, and I hate to put your books in any kind of a genre.
Thank you. Oh, I love you. I feel strongly, too, about that. I knew when I was starting to write Still Life and the rest that these were crime novels, but it never occurred to me that I wasn't writing literary fiction as well, and still doesn't. I completely agree with you. I think the categorization, whether it be science fiction or romance or literary fiction or crime fiction, are marketing issues. Mm-hmm. It makes it easier for bookstores to know where to put the books and easier for people to find the certain types of books that they enjoy reading. But beyond that, it has become a type of literary ghettoization, and in some cases a way to diminish what people are writing. And I think good books are good books, and not even that. How dare I decide what is great? All I know is, as you said, what do I like to read? Mm. What book do I like to read? And that's the only thing that matters. I completely agree. Thank you for that.
I'd also like to note that you have a superb radio voice. How did you come by that?
Gin. Cigar.
Gin? Okay. Don't you have a background?
I'm in the Turkish prison.
Oh, that would have been rocky then. Didn't you have a background in radio?
I do, but it's so interesting. I've tried to figure this out, too. I'm not sure I started with a radio voice. Was it self-selecting? Did I end up in radio because of the voice? Or did this kind of just happen over years of doing radio? I don't actually know, although I did save one of my first... I started off as a news reporter in radio for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. I was about 22, and I listened to my first report, and I sounded like Minnie Mouse. I was so terrified. It was like this. And now something... So I'm not sure at what stage the radio voice kicked in or whether I'm hoping it's just natural.
Hmm. Well, 13 years.
Thank you for that.
Sure. 13 years, 13 books. You're a machine. How do you do it?
Do you know what it is? I love writing. I don't know what I would do if I didn't. I seem to have an endless well of criminal thoughts. But really, I write 1,000 words a day, and sometimes that takes 2 hours, sometimes it takes 6 hours. But if I wasn't writing, I don't know what else I would do that would give me as much pleasure. It takes me about a year and a half to write each book. I think about a book for about 6 months before I start writing it. So as I'm finishing one book, because as you mentioned before, they're very intertwined now. They're almost like one long book cut into 13 chapters in terms of the character's development, not necessarily the crimes themselves. So I love writing. And there's a line from, here we go again, Auden's, this is an elegy to Yeats, a fabulous poem, clearly after Yeats died. And in it he says, "Mad Ireland hurt him into poetry." Which is one of my favorite lines ever, because in 6 or 7 words, you learn everything you need to know about Ireland, about Yeats, and about poetry. And I was the same way. I led quite a privileged life as a child, and I as a result, and I think it was just who I was. I was a kind of callow, not realizing it, of course, but I sort of bumbled through life thinking everything would always be fine, and of course, it wasn't. And I had to be hurt into writing, had to experience enough things in my life to have something to say. And now I guess I had enough hurts and enough joy and God knows enough love and experienced enough goodness and forgiveness that I can write a book a year about these issues.
Well, I think some people have noticed you. I think there's some people that love your work, Louise, and it's really been a pleasure talking to you about it.
And I, you, Vic, thank you.
And I also see where you got that page in the Sunday New York Times book section where they asked you those questions, and that must have just been a delight to be asked to do that.
Oh, but very hard to winnow it down.
Yeah.
Gosh. But it was, yes, it was wonderful too. To stare into space and to remember and think about books.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Book Nook. My guest has been Louise Penny. Her book is Glass Houses for The Book Nook. I'm Vic McKeonis.